Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to welcome back Bruce Allison, professional arborist, author of the book If Trees Could Talk from Wisconsin Historical Society Press. He's also author of Every Root and Anchor in its second edition and Wisconsin's Champion Trees, and has been a regular guest on our program for quite a few years now. It's great to have him back. And certainly, if you have some questions as we talk trees and shrubs a bit today with him, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. And Bruce, welcome back.
Well, Larry, it's great to be back with you and your audience.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you. And we've already have emails come in, and every one of our lines is filled. Christine has emailed us from Madison. She has a maple tree that has had black spots on the underside of the leaves. This year, she's seeing a lot of green bumps on the leaves. What do you think's happening? Are the two issues related?
Not necessarily. We certainly this spring had a foliar fungal problem on the maples. Silver maples were loaded with them, and so were the other maples. It's very typical. If you have a cool, wet spring, which we certainly did, you'll get a foliar fungal problem. The good news is that usually there is not enough leaf involvement to really slow down the tree's ability to produce carbohydrates through photosynthesis. So that's less of a problem. And the bumps are kind of interesting gall formation. There's an interesting relationship between plants and animals often. Insects are able to co-evolve with certain plants, and they, in essence, parasitize them. They go on there, they stimulate that plant to grow a gall or a pocket in which they can hide, and it's very common on maples to get these mite spindle galls, in which if you were to open them up, you'd indeed see that it's a pouch, and the nymphs of those insects are able to hide on the inside. So it's interesting. And again,
not a problem.
There's not a problem in terms of significant loss of growth for that tree. And I always like to think in my romantic sense that there is a symbiotic relationship. That is, the tree is gaining something from it. I haven't quite figured out what
it is.
But that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist.
Michael emailed us. He says, we had a nursery plant person plant a 15-foot-plus multi-trunked river birch a year ago in early May. It was planted with the burlap ball and wire basket left intact. The tree is alive but not thriving. What can I do to save this tree?
Well, it's a good question because we certainly are much more aware than we ever were before in terms of the proper planting techniques and the recommendation coming from the Department of Natural Resources and various other universities across the United States suggests that there is a disadvantage to leaving the wire basket on, and the disadvantage ought to be somewhat obvious. As those roots grow, they're up against this immovable object and have to either grow around it, or sometimes that wire tends to grow or the root tends to grow around the wire, and the wire becomes in essence embedded inside that root, and that's not particularly good. So without question, those wire baskets should, if at all possible, be fully removed. If that cannot occur, then minimally lay them flat so they're just in one plane lower down beneath where the majority of roots are going to be growing. But if you can get the whole thing out, great. Sometimes it's not so easy because they use the wire baskets for the larger individual trees to be moved, and it's pretty hard to lift it up. But if you can, get those snippers in there, pull it out while you still got the hole. Same with the burlap. You definitely don't want that burlap fully intact. Particularly, you don't want to have that little twine that holds the top of the burlap up against the trunk of the tree. I can't tell you how many times, 2 or 3, 4 years after someone has already spent $400 or $500 to plant that tree and worked very hard to keep it going, all of a sudden it's showing decline symptoms, and I go there and realize that that twine is now embedded. And it used to be we would have essentially biodegradable twine. That's no longer the case. Yeah. Now we have plastic polypropylene twine. So if you can, without question, the best strategy is to get rid of all that either metal or cloth material that's holding that up, get the burlap out, and minimally, if you can't get it all the way out, lay it flat so that it's on the bottom. Cut away as much as you can. A lot of extra effort, but the nursery should know that.
Yep, they should. Mary Jo in Poinette, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Mary Jo.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was hoping you could tell me a little something about oak wilt. When we bought our property about 2 years ago, the previous owners mentioned that it was on the neighboring property. And we have just a majestic handful of 100-year-old oaks on right around the house. And we've seen now that on the edge of our property, there are a couple oak trees that are completely dead or have started showing brown leaves in the middle of summer. It looks like they're on their way out.
Well, Mary Jo, you're right to want to know all you can about oak wilt because it's a major problem. It's been one of my nemesis for the many years that I have been involved in tree care. Oak wilt is a systemic fungus. It's a fungus that is able to enter the vascular system of the tree. It then catches a ride in the evapotranspiration train of water nutrients that are moving up into the upper crown of the tree. The tree responds to the presence of this foreign pathogen by sending out little balloon-like projections that come from the outside of those tracheid or straw-like cells that are the xylem. And there's little teeny pits built into the outside wall. And this tyloses are little growths that come out and close it up. Now, that would be a great idea if your intent is to stop a pathogen coming in and keep it from going to the rest of the tree. Unfortunately, the relationship is such that on red oaks particularly, which have very wide vascular system, it's very easy for these pathogens to move through, that it closes itself down and consequently no water can get to the upper crown. And that's why they're wilt diseases. You will have those leaves be essentially dried out. They will then turn brown and upsize or drop. And as I mentioned, red oaks, when the infection occurs, there's almost 100% mortality, and it happens within a very short time. Burrs and white oaks have an equal opportunity for infection, but because of their anatomy, if you were to take a look at a microscope, you'd see that those vessels are already kind of full of gum materials and little tyloses, and you wonder how any water can get through there. Well, it makes an obstacle course for the pathogen to move through, and so quite often you will have, if you have an oak, a white or a bur oak, an infection just in a few branches, and it won't have moved all the way through. Consequently, the mortality rate's only about, 10% on those two species. The other way, and wounds are the point of entry or ingress for that fungal material. After a wound is made in an oak tree during the growing season, you will have about 24 hours before that wound is closed up. And during that 24 hours, if there's the presence of the pathogen, that is spores or any kind of vegetative part of the fungus in the air, it lands on there and can possibly get in. And there's also a little insect called the knitted doodled beetle or the picnic beetle that is able to be attracted to fresh wounds and might have visited an infected tree before and brought some things over. After about 24, at most 48 hours, those have occluded, and so a wound is not a continuous open point of entry. So about 10% of the infections that occur on oaks are a result of wounding. Very important not to wound your oak tree during the vulnerable period, and the high transmission time is from about April 1st to about middle of July, from bud break to full leaf development. But it's possible to get an infection later, and so most people are being very cautious by saying, well, I'm not going to go back to pruning until after October 1, and that seems reasonable,
sure.
Although certain organizations like utility clearance people, it's not unreasonable for them to go back a little bit earlier, well beyond the high transmission time. So the other way for infections to occur is through root grafts. If you have same species, that is red to red, white to white, and they're near each other, those roots can touch and vegetatively graft. Well, that's fine during periods of need of one tree can't get enough water, so it borrows some from the neighboring ones, but it does create a problem or a bridge for those infections to move. That's why the majority of oak wilt infection occurs in pockets. And so if you have same species oaks that are on the edge and they're about 50 or 60 feet away from your trees, you have, and it was oak wilt that killed those trees, you have the potential for that infection to move in. So you definitely want to identify what species you have. You want to know for sure if it was oak wilt or not. And even if it wasn't oak wilt, you don't want to have recently dead trees around because there's also an insect called the two-line chestnut borer, Agrillus bilineatus, which is a problem and can, on recently dead trees, build up a population and then create problems for neighboring oaks. So I hope, Mary Jo, that's been of some help. And if you've got a collection of 100-year-old trees, you definitely want to be on top of oak wilt. And I hope my little lecture has been helpful.
Thank you so much.
You're
Thanks
welcome.
So much for calling. And you'd certainly recommend, Mary Jo, talk to the neighbors about cutting those completely dead trees now and get them out of there.
Absolutely. And many municipalities, in order to protect the resource of even on private property, their trees will create nuisance ordinances that would suggest that if you have a dead oak tree, especially if it's died of oak wilt, it's important to take it down. So they also have another layer of protection for individuals.
Nancy in Madison, we turn to you now. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I'm so glad you're on today. I have a serviceberry that was planted in the spring, and it has developed what they say is a bacterial infection, they think. It occurred at the kind of a wound where they had trimmed the tree, I believe, because you can see that there was a branch there, and fluid just pours up down the trunk. And the local company was very willing to replace the tree, but they brought another one to replant in that spot. And that tree also, when they took it out of the truck, they realized that tree also had the disease. So what I'm wondering is, first of all, is a serviceberry better to be a shrub than try to force it to be a tree? And second, it's depressing to look at this now.
Really
happy to have it. And, I think now they won't try to replace this year. And is it a danger to my other tree? Should I try and get rid of it? And, well, I'll stop there.
Okay. Well, to answer your first question, is it better as a shrub than a tree? No, not necessarily. I mean, there are, many, many beautiful tree form serviceberries, around the state. And I think that should be a very important part of, the palette of possible tree plantings in urban areas. So I wouldn't discourage the use of Amelanchier or serviceberry at all. It's a native tree. And I'm guessing if they told you it was a bacterium as opposed to a fungus, that it might have something called fire blight. And fire blight is indeed a bacterial disease that can occasionally affect, crab apples, and the serviceberry is obviously in that rosacea family. It looks a little bit like a crab apple, although it's not, a true malus, or it's not in that particular individual, species or genus. But if you see it, and it can come from the nursery, there's no question about it. Some of these, it's a problem that you want to get rid of right away. It does not really affect a broad range of other trees. I mean, if you have an oak nearby or a maple, you don't have to worry about it. And it's one that, like any bacterium, once it gets started, can just keep on going. And it is often transmitted by people pruning infected part of a branch and then going to another part of that same tree or another susceptible host and not disinfecting their tools. It's the same kind of concept of sanitation that we have, in the medical sciences.
Sure.
Quite often, because it's a topical, it doesn't really become systemic. You can just cut out that infected part. And doing so, when it's not wet out so that you don't, spread it, and using isopropyl alcohol or rubbing alcohol, I usually like, 70-90% isopropyl to disinfect those tools, it might be able to grow right on. And it depends, where that infection occurs. If it's on the main trunk, it's somewhat more problematic. If it's on a smaller lateral or branch out there, you might be able to cut it out and move on. If they're willing to replace it, great. If the one that they brought in is showing the same infective material, then they obviously are going to take a look at their source and their nursery and make sure that it's not an infection that's broadly scattered in whatever the growing nursery is. But I would not give up on it as a tree. I think it's a wonderful choice. There are just a few problems with it. Occasionally you can get scab, depending upon weather conditions, but that's just a occasional occurrence. And there's a little insect called the pear slug, which is actually a sawfly, but in its larval stage can do some feeding there and leave little, you know, browned out spots. But, you know, life is full of, you know, different passing problems out there. And it's, you know, it's the, you know, total end result. So I would encourage you to, you know, if you like that, serviceberry is an absolutely gorgeous flower in the spring. I would reconsider that and not be afraid. It's nothing that's in your soil or on your site. It was actually, you know, brought in or, you know, a wound was made at the wrong time. You don't want to be pruning any fire blight susceptible plants in the very early spring or really throughout the spring. You want to wait until the tissue becomes a little bit more hardened than you have in the early spring.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Bruce Allison, professional arborist, our guest today as we talk with him about trees and shrubs. Dave Poltratz, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in on this edition of Garden Talk as we talk trees and shrubs with Bruce Allison, give us a call at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Frank in Ferryville next. Frank, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. It's been my experience that apple trees, whether they be the kind we eat or a flowering crab, have extremely tender bark, and if they get bumped, they don't seem to heal quite as well as perhaps some other varieties of trees do. I know we used to, years ago, talk about painting those. I think that's out now. But is there some way of treating a wound like that on an apple tree?
Well, it depends how the wound is made, Frank. If it's a pruning wound, the most critical thing you can do is to prune to the right area of the limb that you're cutting off. And if you prune properly, the probability of a good closure and minimizing the opportunity for any secondary problems or additional growth of a wound such as cankering above and below has been dramatically reduced. So let me just start with that. So if you're talking about pruning your apple trees, number one, as we had just mentioned in that earlier comment from Nancy from Madison, you want to be careful when you prune your apple trees and not do it during that vulnerable period when you might be spreading problems such as fire blight. So if you choose the right time of year to do it, you want to select the branch that you're cutting. And the branch, imagine you're cutting a big branch back to a smaller branch. You want to make sure that that ratio is no greater than 3-1, no less than 3-1, that is. You want to make sure that the branch you're cutting to is at least one-third the diameter of the one you're cutting. And so that's step number one. Number two, if you're just cutting any lateral branch and a smaller branch back to a bigger stem, you want to find the junction of that lateral branch to the main stem, and you should see a little swelling of cells there in a ring, sometimes concentric rings. That's called the branch bark collar. Collar, right. Just like the collar of your shirt. You want to cut to that. Those are specialized cells that are able to divide quite rapidly, and then that will close up the wound. It's also a spot that allows the minimum amount of exposure for ingress of saprophytic or decay pathogens. So you want to prune properly. You're right. We no longer use tree wound dressing. When I started, many years ago, I would always carry that little red paint pot up in the tree, you know, strapped to my rope and saddle as I'm going up there, and I'd hate it because by the end of the day, I'd be covered with all that tar. We now know that it doesn't inhibit the introduction of decay. In fact, it creates an environment more conducive by creating, you know, moisture up against there and not allowing natural sunlight with its ultraviolet, which is the enemy of fungus. And
actually, though, I'm more concerned about bumping the base of the
yes.
tree with a mower.
Okay. Well, and you're right. If you do that, it does create a major problem for the tree, and especially if it's on that main part of the trunk away from a lateral branch. First step is preventative medicine. I mean, put a ring of mulch around there so you don't have to mow directly against that. If that's impossible, then minimally put some sort of one of those little, you know, lightweight plastic curlicue kind of protectors so that it's got an extra level of protection, sort of like wearing a helmet when you're riding your bike. So, if you get a bump there, it's not going to penetrate through. Once the wound has occurred and you couldn't help it, having all the loose bark that might be hanging on, either buckled up or just sort of little shreds on the end, cut that off with a sharp pruning scissors or pruning shears so that you don't have it hanging there and you have less surface area for the decay to occur and you have maximum amount of air and sunlight, two things that will minimize the amount of infection going on. And keep the plant vigorous because a tree is not without defense. It is, if it's vigorous, is able to create both biochemical and anatomical defenses against the movement of that fungus that can now enter because you've taken away the skin, and you can minimize the opportunity for a cavity to form there and maximize the growth of that tissue on the periphery that can close up and eventually form that cat's eye so the tree can grow and have an annual ring on back of that. So those are the things that I'd recommend. Number one, if you do anything you can to avoid wounding, and number two, keep the plant vigorous and pull away any of the loose bark that might be hanging around the edges. It used to be that we would say go in there and, you know, scribe it in an oval shape. Don't do that because you end up creating a wider wound that way, and it's not really needed as long as you can peel, cut off some of the loose tissue. Frank, I hope that's been of some help.
Yeah.
Well, so do I understand that one should not put one of these tree wraps around that wound?
Correct. And what I was talking about to give it some extra protection would be these, you know, plastic springy curlicue
right.
protectors at the base. You've seen those. They've actually got holes in them, so you still get ventilation. You still get some sunlight going through it, and its sole purpose is to prevent the wound. If you already have a wound, do not put tree wrap around there. There has been some research that shows if you have a really large wound, that if you immediately after the wound occurs, put down some plastic over it and then seal it with some duct tape around there, that keeping it moist for the next 3 to 4 days will make sure that you don't have further desiccation of those tissue, those cells that are right around the edge that have the potential to divide and start closing. But that, I think, would be applicable only if you have a big wound. If you have a smaller wound, I don't think it's going to make much difference. It's the same thing that, you know, again, now our better understanding of mammalian, you know, medicine you want to keep those wounds a little moist for a short time with, you know, Vaseline or whatever, not to carry the comparison between people and trees too far because it's not much of a comparison. But in some cases, yes, there's been research at different universities that would suggest that keeping it a little bit moist with that, extra plastic on there for a short time so it doesn't desiccate, would have some positive effect.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Thank you kindly. I'm changing something right now.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling, Frank. Appreciate it. Jan in Waukon, Iowa. We turn to you now. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I have a question about an oak tree that I think a squirrel planted it in the ditch across from my house and forgot to dig it up.
Okay.
Can I go over there and dig that up and put it in my yard?
You bet. As long as it's, you know, fairly small, you can have the potential to transplant. Oaks are, you know, kind of difficult to get because they, in that juvenile stage, have usually a very deep taproot. They're very, drought tolerant, and that's because they're able to very quickly send it straight down where it can get the maximum amount of moisture. So you'd like to get as much of that root ball as you possibly can. And so it might mean a pretty good sized ball a soil ball that you're going to bring with it. But that, you know, the more of it you can get, obviously, the better prospects for success, knowing that transplant shock or transplant failure is usually a function of an insufficient root-to-crown ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's fairly small, no reason you can't dig it out. And even if you don't know exactly where you want to put it eventually, you could put it into a pot where you know where the roots are going to be and let it grow there. I mean, make sure it's an adequately sized pot for all that soil to fit in. Take care of it and then consider, you know, replanting that in the spring.
Okay.
Or you might even want to wait until next spring to pull this plant out so that you don't have to go through that period of desiccation during the winter that seems inevitable once you pull it out with the minimized root system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sounds like a good idea. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Doug and Amory emailed us and says, it appears something bored a whole bunch of quarter-inch by eighth-inch deep holes in the trunk of a crimson birch in my yard. I see large black bees chewing on the edges of these holes. What gives there? He's wondering about whether to cut the tree down and wonders if something would sprout from the stump if he did.
Okay, and you said large black bees. Is that
what
you
said?
Okay, yeah, so probably a wasp of some sort that's working over there. And the holes in the birch, well, that is a couple different possibilities. On birch, you can certainly get something called bronze birch borer. Bronze birch borer is an insect that affects trees that are, affects birch trees that for some reason lack vigor. It's a beetle, ubiquitous beetle. It's always around, but it's pulled into the birch once the birch is stressed. And when it's stressed, it emits these biochemical signals to which the beetle is attuned. They have receptors to pick up these parts per billion chemicals that come in the air when the tree is under stress and then are attracted to it, number one. And then number two, if there's not sufficient amount of water in there, when the beetle lays its egg, the larva then hatches and starts to go in. A healthy birch tree is able to pitch out, that is, flood that first hole with water and drown the larval stage. End of story. However, if it's insufficient water, it can't pitch it out. It gets in. It starts to feed beneath the bark, sever those vascular cells just beneath the bark, further depress the health of that individual tree. And then before you know it, the bronze birch borer is taken over. So it's maybe possible. It's going to be those holes that you would see would not be the ingress holes, but rather the emergence holes, because after that little critter pupates and emerges as an adult beetle, it then has to drill its way out. And it's, if the holes are fairly scattered around, they're not in any sort of orderly fashion, and they tend to have a D shape, that is a capital D shape to them, flat on one side, arced on the other, that would be the characteristic sign of the bronze birch borer. If that's the case, try to invigorate that tree, put in a pesticide, the least toxic that you can find, onto the bark in order to dissuade other beetles from laying their eggs and moving into it also to further depress the tree. Now, it could very well be that it's not the bronze birch borer, but it's sapsuckers.
Yeah.
And that can also, that size is it's going to be a bigger size. But they tend to be in horizontal or vertical. The brain of that bird's a little bit bigger, and they tend to be orderly as opposed to the insect, which will just sort of be a scattered holes. So in that, once the wound is made, the tree is pitching out. Just like I said before, the sap comes out, and that could, because it's very sweet, that could be why you have wasps. And, you know, I don't know, maybe there are bees. I don't recognize that color description, but they're going after the sweetness associated with that. I don't think that those insects you see, those bee-like insects you see flying around, are actually the cause of the wound.
No.
And it's more likely they're just feeding there. It's of interest. There's a lot of sugar in birch sap, and the Native Americans would actually, in addition to tapping the sugar maples, tap birch. And have fair amount of sugary material once they were able to evaporate it out.
Jerry in Trempealeau, we turn to you now. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Larry and Bruce. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I've got some white pines that are probably 20 years old that I need to prune, and I'm worried about the white pine blister rust.
You bet. You should be worried about the white pine blister rust. It's huge. And, Jerry, you're worried that you might be infecting the trees through the pruning tools?
Yeah, or just airborne spores.
Yeah. Well, the white pine blister rust, and you have less of it because we have selected more disease-resistant varieties of white pines these days. And I don't know if you planted these or the DNR provided those a long time ago or whether they're just, you know, older trees. The more mature trees are going to be less problematic. The white pine blister rust is a lot of those people that were in forestry years ago know one of the ways to dissuade the infections is to prune out the lower branches so you have better ventilation and less periods of moisture on the needles, because indeed the white pine blister rust doesn't need a wound to come in. It is able to enter through the needles, and then it resides in a woody tissue and causes a ulceration or canker. And it's that localized topical canker that inhibits the ability of those vascular cells to carry water and nutrients up. And that's why you end up having, you know, browned out trees. But you can always trace it back to these ulcerations in the bark. And if you reduce enough of the circumference of that bark, you're going to have the demise of a tree. So I think that if you're talking about just pruning some lower branches to increase the ventilation, it was not going to be an issue. Certainly don't do it when there is moisture in the air. Try to choose a drier time of year in order to do your pruning. And I think that pruning would not, you know, in any way increase the probability of white pine blister rust infection.
All right. Thanks for calling, Jerry. Appreciate it. Lynn in Evansville, on to you now. Hi, Lynn.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, the feature tree in my front yard, although it's not the only tree, is a clump of white birch. It's actually triplets with diameters of the trunks between 12 and 16 inches, so I really love these trees. I noticed that there are three quick questions. I noticed that after it rains, the crotch of the tree actually forms a basin, and I have a pool of standing water in there for several days. And I'm wondering, is this injurious to the tree? Is there something I should be doing to prevent any kind of rot or disease at that point?
Okay, well, I'll speak to the three questions individually as you progress. Having a little, you know, bucket effect, which comes when you've got the two branches that are joined, but they're not knit together, and so they have a little bit of included bark, and you create a little pocket between those two. As long as the bark is intact, you have a lot of suberin or waxy material in that bark, it is not going to necessarily let that moisture penetrate in there into the white wood, which is the part that's going to become, you know, infected if you'd had a wound. Yes, indeed, having moisture kind of come and go creates an environment more conducive to decay, as we know from, you know, just, you know, dimensional lumber. If it gets wet and dry and wet and dry, we have that kind of dry rot effect going on. And we don't want to have that occurring on that standing tree. But theoretically, as long as there is no area of ingress into the white wood, that the bark is fully intact in that bucket, in theory, we're not going to have an increased probability of infection at that point. You do not want to drill a hole and create a tube to drain that. That's what I used to do back when I started like three decades ago, because we thought that was a good idea to get that water out. But in point of fact, by doing that, we created additional wounding and indeed introduced the saprophytic decay or fungus that would then create the problem for the tree. So don't do that. If having the standing water there seems problematic to you because you're going to have more mosquitoes or whatever, a couple ways to deal with it. Some of my clients have reported that just simply going out there with a turkey baster and just taking the water out every time it rains. Obviously, you have to be a little more on top of it. Do not fill it with a material of any sort, either concrete or these foams that are put in. If you have the capability of putting sort of a little shingle kind of roof on it, a cap of some sort, either made from just regular shingle material, asphalt shingle material, or maybe some thin, tin material that can be shaped. Doesn't have to be nailed in, but just sort of put on top so that the downward moving water is then shed away from it. It doesn't fill up that bucket. That's a fine idea also. I've actually had some people, if you have the right position for it, putting Gore-Tex over it, as long as the Gore-Tex, is formed a cap and doesn't, become collapsed and holds water in itself. But the Gore-Tex keeps the water from coming in and keeps that critical part of the air circulating in there and evaporation carrying any water away from there. So those are some possibilities, but don't do any additional wounding there, Lynn.
Good. On the next question, and very briefly, I noticed one of the last rains that as the water ran down the lower portion of the trunk of one of the stems, there seemed to be a white foamy material, which I'd never noticed before. Does this mean I should call the arborist back in?
Well, the foamy material is probably emanating from a crack or some kind of small wound that might be there. And that foaminess could be a function of a secondary, bacterium that can sometimes follow infections because it's a bacterium, creates a frothy effect and comes out. So that's one possibility. But if you don't see a large wound, and if it's only occurring during periods of significant moisture, I don't think I would consider that to be a high problem issue.
Oh, good.
And I don't think you really need to call back an arborist.
And last but not least, the gentleman who brought the mulch for the tree, I have mulch at the base of the tree, told me that the trailing branches, I have trailing branches that kind of bend down. It competes for sunlight to some extent because I have some large maples as well. And I like that effect because it kind of gives me some privacy. But he indicated that, in fact, I should prune those because he felt it was injurious to the tree. Is there any truth in that fact? Should I have those trimmed?
Did he make an argument why they might have been injurious to the tree?
No.
Yeah, unless there is some, poor connection that you've increased the probability of a break or whatever, a tree has a certain wisdom. Zona Gale, who was one of our great poets, used to talk about trees. There's a certain intelligence here that surpasses our understanding. And, it's an evolved kind of intelligence, not to, anthropomorphize plants, but... that lower growth is producing carbohydrates for the tree and
right.
is benefiting that lower part of the trunk. If it's not a problem for you, if you don't have an increased probability of breaks occurring because people are walking by or it's not, as you, indicated, it's looking for sunlight. Plants are heliotropic. They're sending those shoots out where there's light to grow and they're stimulated to grow where there is light. There is nothing per se that would suggest that that's a bad problem for the tree.
Wonderful.
Sometimes people are, kind of extrapolate from, say, a big tree, you have what's known as suckering or adventitious budding coming out from lower down, and they're convinced somehow that that's stealing nutrients from the other part of the tree. And that's not the case either. We have a theory in arboriculture called the autonomous limb theory that says each limb has to produce its own food, and then if you would tithe or contribute to the main part of the tree that is not photosynthetic, the roots, the bark, the trunk, and whatever. And if it can't produce its own food, it can't borrow from a neighboring limb that's in full sunlight. And so consequently, that any branch that's occurring there is not really taking from the tree. It's making a contribution, in fact.
Fascinating. Thank you both.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bruce Allison, professional arborist, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking trees and shrubs today with Bruce Allison, our professional arborist, Larry Mueller here. Thank you very much for listening in on this edition of Garden Talk. Lots of callers online, so we'll turn to the phones again and to Wayne in Green Bay. Wayne, hello.
Hello. I have some peach trees that were designed to grow in Upper Michigan. They were called Reliance trees.
Okay.
And last year I had a lot of nice fruit on it. This year I had half the tree had leaves on it. The other half of the tree was bare. And the leaves that did have, the part that did have the leaves on it, they were like wilted a bit. And also there was a bunch of sap that was coming out of the bark.
Yeah.
On the tree itself. What do I have? I mean, it's like half the tree is dead and half the tree is alive.
Yeah. And that's one of the problems with, you know, the peach trees, the apricot trees. I mean, sometimes you can just have great crops and there's nothing quite like, you know, a peach from your own tree in your own backyard. On the other hand, over and over again, I see this problem of peach borer particularly. I mean, there are other different, you know, fungal or canker problems, but peach borer is the one that I see most often, which is, it's a beetle. It's a ubiquitous beetle. It's always around, and it particularly likes those peach and apricot trees. And the sap exuding from the lower part of the trunk, if you were to kind of clean that off a little bit, you just, you know, it's usually water or soap soluble. You can kind of, you know, maybe look for holes there. And because the borer is attracted to the tree, and if there's any kind of stress particularly, it doesn't successfully pitch it out, but it's attempting to. And so those little sap bubbles that you see scattered throughout usually the lower part of the trunk or maybe on that same half that you're seeing the dieback, and if the borer gets in there, just like we were talking about with the bronze birch borer, it will then start to have pupation and feeding galleries underneath, sever those trachid cells, those xylem cells that are carrying water and nutrients up, and then part of the tree can't get enough. And so it kind of has stunted leaves and doesn't successfully grow. Whereas the other half, because of this thing called segmented architecture of trees that, you know, one side tends of the trunk and root systems tends to be more fully connected with that side of the crown and feeding it. So you can have one half of it doing fine that doesn't have those injuries or those areas of severing of the xylem cells, doing one side doing fine, the other not doing well. So double check for that and see. I suspect that's what you have as a peach borer problem. If you've got 50% crown dieback, it might be too late. But on the other hand, it might be worth an effort to. You can use some of those, you know, borer specific insecticides on that lower part of the trunk, and then again work with the plant by having that mulch ring around it to create an environment more conducive to good root growth. Make sure that you have adequate moisture to go through. Don't go through any droughty period. And this winter, or just before the winter, just before that ground freeze, I would like you to just soak up that soil heavily, almost to field capacity, almost to flooding going on there. Your Green Bay, I don't think, you know, because you've got that fractured, you know, Niagara escarpment or dolomitic limestone underneath, you shouldn't have any problems of flooding. And what that does is, as it freezes, it fractures the soil and makes better growing environment for the roots, and also guarantees you that you'll have adequate moisture there as you go into the spring, just in case we happen to have a particularly dry winter and not the usual amount of snow cover up there. So those will also help. That extra moisture will reduce the depth of the frost so that you won't have that same rootlet attrition that happens during most winters on that. So I would try to identify and see if my over-the-air diagnosis is right, that you're dealing with peach borer there.
All right.
All right. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome,
thanks.
Wayne.
Thanks, Wayne. Bethany in West Bend, on to you now. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And Bruce, I have a question about lilac bushes.
Okay.
Our lilacs are probably, 25, 30 years old, and they need to be trimmed. And I'm wondering at what point in the season to do that, and how far down to cut them off. I've had people say, you know, 4 feet off the ground, 3 feet, and so that's okay. My question.
Well, Bethany, I'm glad you called.
Because, and I love my lilac bushes, and I really, they're a natural fence line to the neighbors, and
sure.
So it creates a nice privacy barrier, and so to cut them down, I really don't want to do that, but I know that it's time and they need to be pruned.
Yeah, well, lilacs certainly are a very important part of our Wisconsin heritage. You know, you can see lilac bushes on old farmsteads that have been growing for 150 years. They have such beautiful color. And, you know, the heirloom lilacs, particularly, yours are 30 years old, so they're not in that heirloom category. But
Some are younger. But most of them are older.
And so often people mistakenly think that all you need to do is just sort of, you know, take a certain elevation, 4 feet, 2 feet, ground level, and just cut them off. And that's probably the worst thing you can do because that creates a significant problem. What you want to do is selectively prune out the older stems. Your idea is to maximize the bloom and to have adequate screening from these. And so if you were to just, you know, cut down to a certain level, you're going to be increasing those areas of decay and cavities that are forming, because any kind of truncating cut is inappropriate on any woody plant. So if you were instead to take a look at the structure of those trees, of those shrubs, you'll see that there are some younger stems coming up. I call those juvenile. They're smaller in diameter. You'll see the older ones that are wider, because each annual ring that is laid down each year increases the diameter of those stems. You will want to lower the plant, because you get more sunlight penetrating lower down. You'll stimulate those more juvenile tissue to grow and fill in just where you want the screening. And you'll keep the floral display lower, because you want to enjoy it. It doesn't help if it's, you know, 25 feet up in the air.
Right. I have some of them that are that tall. And
exactly.
And the blooms are, you know, way up high, and it needs to be shaped and brought down.
So you do that by simply finding those older stems, cutting those all the way back down. And
all the way to the ground.
If it seems inappropriate.
All the way to the ground?
Well, some of those. If you have to just, again, instructions are fine if I knew exactly, you know, what plant was, but my knowledge base can be misconstrued, and you can have one of those exceptions out there. If you have a stem that you seems unreasonable to cut all the way down, because that would take away too much of the growth of the tree, you can find a lower lateral branch that is smaller and is more recently growing, and then cut back to that.
Okay.
And again, as you might have remembered when I spoke before, if you were, you know, listening on the radio, I talked about that 3-to-1 rule. If you're going to cut a bigger stem to a smaller stem, that smaller stem should be at least 1/3 the diameter of the larger one that you're cutting.
Okay.
So, you know, think about, before you make the cut, imagine in your mind's eye what the end product is going to be.
Okay.
Are you then going to have a nice, more compact, lower, denser growth over time, where your floral buds are going to be, you know, at the view that you want to have? And I would strongly suggest that you go on to the University Learning Store website and download an excellent bulletin that our horticulture professor, Dr. Laura Jull, has put together on pruning deciduous shrubs. And she will, in their step-by-step, and in there's graphics that really help a tremendous amount. She also has another wonderful booklet that is specifically on lilacs, and it sounds, Bethany, that you're one of those people that would appreciate that.
Oh, yeah.
I think you can download that also.
And what website is that?
Our University Extension, University of Wisconsin Extension, has now named their website the Learning Store.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
so if you type in UW Extension Learning Store, or I think it's Learning Store. Well, if you type that in, you're going to get it.
Yeah, you'll get there, and then you'll go to the horticulture site, and you'll look under lilac, both for, you know, pruning deciduous shrubs and a general bulletin on lilacs, which I think you'd enjoy very much.
Oh, definitely. That sounds just perfect. And so Don't cut the branches all the way down to the ground, is what you're saying. Take a look at how they fit with the rest of the shrub.
Yeah,
and
well,
because most of the blooms are up high, and
yes.
if you cut those branches off, will the blooms come back on lower?
Yes, every year the tree will set down both foliar buds and floral buds. And so that's why people usually will wait until after the bud break and floral display before they go in to prune, because they want to enjoy that year's floral bud. If you cut right after that, then you will still have some additional growth in which additional floral buds are now being produced lower down. And you have to have adequate sunlight to have a floral bud. And that's why the lower part of the tree, even though you have some vegetation down there, doesn't have the flowers. So you want to bring the whole thing down. You don't want the top to shade it. And some of those big stems you will want to bring all the way back down, yes. But you want to do so judiciously. But you don't want to just make a cut everything down or cut it at a certain level, because those truncating cuts will not give you the results that you're looking for.
And thank you very much for calling. And our thanks to Bruce Allison, professional arborist, on this edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bruce Allison. So if you have a tree or shrub question, I hope you'll join in. Lots of callers online, so we go right to the phones, and Terry in Green Bay up next. Terry, hi.
Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
First off, I'd like to say how fortunate we are to have Bruce on your show. I look forward to it. His knowledge of the plant world is just mind-blowing.
Well, thank you, Terry.
You're welcome. Here's my question. I've got some native balsam evergreens that I put in pots roughly 3 to 4 years ago. They're getting to be an average of 3 feet plus. I haven't gotten them out in the field. I've got a little over 100 of them because of drought conditions. Excuse me. And I was wondering, they're getting root bound. How big a problem am I going to run into? I might try this year, and just because it's just, so time consuming to water them out
yes.
in the field.
Yep.
Planted. How much of a problem am I going to have if I try to spread as much of the root system out when slipping them out of the pots and then planting them into the site?
Well, it's going to be a lot more effort as they become more root-bound. But you're talking about doing that next spring. Are you ready to move them out?
I was hoping we'd get some rain. I was going to try some in the next week or two, but mm-hmm. we haven't gotten any rain.
Yeah. I would be inclined, Harry, to wait until the spring. You put them out in the field, they're just a little bit more vulnerable to problems and to winter damage. They're in that pot now. They're somewhat protected. I presume they're, in a holding area where they're maybe a little bit more protected from winds and animals and things like that.
Yes.
Yeah, my inclination would be just for that extra level of security, wait till the spring to plant them. Decide exactly where you want them. Arrange for those holes to be dug to the proper depth. And it will be indeed, an effort for you, depending upon how pot bound they are, to be able to get those roots growing out in a radial direction. But you really want to do that, because if you have any kind of movement in a girdling direction, and of course, if it's left like that, you will end up having problems in short order as that trunk grows. They'll be bumping against roots and tend to girdle. So as much as you can, carefully, so you don't do damage in the process of doing it. But, once you've got take the pot off, put it in the soil at the proper depth, and then as much as possible, make sure that any of those roots that you can get your hands on that you can bring out in a radial direction, which is the normative way for them to grow, indeed are pulled out that way, and then get your soil filled in right away. And I don't know what to say about, the drought issues, but you certainly would want to have some sort of irrigation system, be it a drip irrigation or just simply a bucket brigade, so that in those early years, as they're establishing themselves, they have an adequate amount of moisture. That's a huge issue, especially when you've got, 100, plants you want to bring in, especially firs, which are more susceptible to desiccation, from wind and winter damage.
Okay.
Would you recommend, Bruce, giving them a little bit of water-soluble plant food now like a 2177 high acid, or just leave them?
My inclination would be not to do anything to the soil. If you've had adequate growth, I don't know that at this time of year we're making much of a contribution anyway, and it does take some energy for these plants to pull in the nutrients, even though they have a net gain. So I think I would just have adequate moisture going into the winter in the potted form, and then, you know, wait in the spring, put them in. Water is the most critical element, assuming you have fairly good soils that you're putting them in. Again, how you plant, as you well know, I mean, get that, if you don't already have it, that DNR graphic of how to properly plant trees. And it will make all the difference, you know, 5 or 6 years from now, doing that right and having done your homework. You'll have, you know, just a beautiful grove of gorgeous balsam fir.
Yeah. Thanks, Terry. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Beth in Elm Grove, it's your turn. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I have a question about a ginkgo tree.
Okay.
I planted a small ginkgo tree, I think, 7 or 8 years ago, and it's in partial sun, and it has just hardly grown at all. And I wonder if we should try to transplant it, or if it just takes that long to really get established, and if we should transplant it, whether spring is the best time to do that.
Well, I'll answer the last question first because it's the easiest one. Yeah, spring would be my preferred time to transplant, again, for the same reason that I mentioned before, that it's the root-to-crown ratio, and inevitably, whenever you dig, you're going to leave some of those roots behind. And so if you were to do that in the spring, it has a better chance of sending out new growth right away. And why it hasn't grown, if it has partial sunlight, I mean, you know, it is certainly a, you know, a plant that will do best in good sunlight. And so perhaps that is the reason it hasn't grown very much. They do take a while to get established. Once you have establishment, you'll get rapid growth. But there might be some other elements. Sunlight is an very important one. Moisture levels, soil type, nutrients, anything that might have been a problem at the time of planting. I don't know if again, you heard our earlier discussion about making sure that root burlap is taken off. And, you know, that makes a big difference, too, that will either give a tree a great growing start or would be an impediment to, you know, waits as it tries to grow back. But if you haven't had much growth in 7 to 8 years, you might attribute that to the sunlight issue. And if there's another site that is in better sunlight, that can easily be moved to, you know, perhaps that would be appropriate. But 7 to 8 years has been long enough, I think, to give it a good opportunity in that particular site.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Beth.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Bob in Lyndhurst. Hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Bruce. Thank you for your help. I have a Norway maple about 18 inches in diameter that has had splits in the branches. And actually, I have a split starting about 2 feet off the ground that goes all the way up into the branches ahead. And the tree has become quite sparse on the southern half, and the northern half is just as thick as it had been in the past. So apparently the damage is more to one part of the tree than the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's just talk about those splits a little bit. Splits can sometimes be called seams. That is, you see just the little seam or a line running longitudinally around the trunk or longitudinally around those branches, and
running the length of the branches or the
running the whole length of the branch. Okay.
Yeah, and they're separating, and you know you're seeing the inner part of the tree as opposed to just the bark.
Okay, so those seams can be what we call frost cracks, which are an opening that follows those ray cells, because not only do you have annual rings that are going concentrically around the pith of the tree, but you also have those group of cells called ray cells that connect the outer ring to the inner ring. These are a group of living cells called parenchyma-type cells. And when you have any kind of temperature differential on one side or the other, that it's contracting on one side with cold and expanding on the other side with heat, these are like areas of greater probability of separation. So they're like expansion joints almost, and all of a sudden they pop open. You have this frost crack. They're less of a problem structurally if it's just a radial, that if it just goes from the outer ring into the pith. Where they become a problem is if that crack is all the way through the entire diameter, then it's a major issue. It's no longer a seam. It's indeed a full crack. And structurally, the tree is not nearly as strong because now you've created two separate surfaces that are not connected, and you have all these shear stresses. That is, one part of the tree is going one way and the other is going the other way, and that's where you tend to get the structural failure of the tree over time. So double check to make sure that it's just a radial crack and not entire crack going all the way through the diameter. If it's all the way through, then boy, get a competent arborist out there to determine the probability of failure and structural failure. Now, the other clue that you're telling me that there's something even more serious going on, one half of the tree is showing a problem more than the other. A simple seam or a radial crack is not going to cause an inhibition of those uptake of water and nutrients, because those xylem cells that are carrying the water nutrients up are going to be in that last annual ring. And so by having just a seam there, you are just touching a small section of the periphery. The rest of them are all going to be going up just fine. But that crack might have been a function caused by a girdling root or some root rot underneath that inhibited the ability of that water to come up in that particular part of the tree. And that might explain why that I think you said the southern half is the part that is...
Yeah, I'm losing 50% of the branches. The splits run the full length of the branches.
Okay. Well, then I would suggest that the splits in and of themselves, even though they're running the full length, again, are going to be running parallel to those trachea cells, to those xylem cells carrying. So they're not going to be inhibiting that. If they were girdling, if they're going all the way around, that's when you have created a blockage of those.
They're not running that direction.
They're not running that direction.
That I've seen.
So I think what's really happening is that there's something else going on at the root plate level, either girdling root. So do a little bit of careful excavation around and see if you see a girdling root that is a root that's not going out radially, but rather is wrapping around.
Okay.
That might be inhibiting on that side, or make sure that on that side that's showing the problem, you have a normal buttress root and it's not just going cylindrically into the ground. If it's a cylinder going straight down, there's no taper, that might tell you that indeed you have some root rot going on and you've lost the roots in that particular area.
Okay.
The only issue that I have beyond that is the structural aspect, the safety issue of those branches. And what you have quite often in Norway maple, you know, and it's not unusual for them to have these so-called frost cracks, which are radial, and they usually are helical. That is, rather than just going up and down at a right angle to the plane of the earth, they're going to be wrapping around in a helical fashion, you know, just...
Sure.
And that can be a problem if the wind is blowing in such a way that it kind of creates a pinwheel effect and you have a torquing or a twisting of that trunk, and the twist is opposite where that helical split is. It's like having a three-lay rope where you have a rope made of three different components. It's very strong when it's twisted in that direction of the lay. It becomes quite weak when it's pulled the other way and those three sort of separate, and so it's no stronger than each one of those individually. And that's sometimes where you get a problem with the Norway maple with a split like that. And up in the trunk, again, the same, or up in the limbs, same thing. If you had that a twisting motion, even though it's a longitudinal split, again, you sometimes can create that shearing force one side against the other, and it can kind of unravel, and you can have breaks, and it kind of delaminates and splits off. So just sort of watch that, and that's not at all atypical on Norway maples.
All right.
Thanks very much, Bruce. I appreciate your help.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Email from Ruth, who says there are three large basswood-like trees near our front yard. They belong to the neighbors, but their roots are causing lots of hills in our yard with depressions on either side of the hills, of course. Would it harm the trees to fill in the valleys so that the mowing of the lawn could be easier? It's Ruth and Ladysmith.
Yeah, Ruth, that is not at all an atypical problem, especially if you have some sort of a hard pan and you don't have a large topsoil, so-called, you know, A horizon. The soil scientists call that the A horizon because soil is very stratified. You've got a top layer. And if for some reason you've got a hard pan that is, you know, limestone or packed clay underneath and the roots can't go down, they tend to then stay near the surface. And they will, as they grow and expand, they will form an area that rises above the plane of the existing plane of the soil. Now, that's usually what happens. Be cautious, because sometimes if you have a tree that has a poor root system that's starting to uplift or uproot, that can also cause a rise on one side because those roots, which are normally under tension, like ropes holding that tree back, are now sort of buckling up. And make sure that that's not the case. If that is, you might have a hazard situation. But assuming it's just the normal growth that happens in a hard pan soil, what you could do is indeed fill in some of those lower depressions. Choose to use a light soil, and a light, I mean one that has a little bit more, you know, sand component so that air can leave and water can come down. The opposite of that would be a heavy soil, like a clay soil, where you have very small particles in that soil that tend to group together and it almost forms like a pottery so that you can't get water and nutrients down, and you can't get the gaseous exchange occurring because roots respire just like mammals. They need oxygen because they carry on metabolism with respiration down there. But filling a little bit of lightness there, putting some seed for lawn on top, assuming it's, you know, it's only 6 to 8 to 10 inches, shouldn't be a problem for the tree. You still should have adequate exchange of water percolating through and air exchanging out.
Well, Sean emailed us and has recently graduated from a college with a degree in landscape architecture. His program did not provide much in the way of education about plants, whether it be botany, plant identification, or so forth. I was hoping, he says, that you could suggest some books that might offer some help to someone trying to teach these things to themselves.
Good, Sean. And as you're learning as a recent graduate, that life is a long time learning experience, and you're going to be much more successful in life when you gathered all that information that you took from college. And you might not remember the details, but hopefully you'll remember how to learn. You're in a wonderful field, landscape architecture. I mean, I think that's one of the great fields to be in right now. There's no question, as we understand, that the plants around us are going to be part of our salvation. They always were, but we never realized it more than we do now with, you know, issues of sustainability and issues of global climate change and excess amount of carbon being distributed into the air. We know that plants are going to be a very important component of it. I would say that if you want to have some information in terms of arboriculture, there's an excellent book, which is just by that name. Matheny, Clark, and Davis are the three authors. It's an excellent book. Most recent one, I think, came out in 07. I would definitely get that. There is another book simply called Trees, and who is the author? British author. Troth or Tooth, something along those lines, but it's simply called The Tree. And you can't read that without, at the end of it, realizing what a remarkable organism trees are. Plenty of other plants you should, you know, be studying in terms of selecting landscape plants. Michael Durr, and he's the author of a book, which I think is just simply called Landscape Plants, but it's a nice listing of all the different possible shrubs and trees that you might want to have knowledge of to be able to plant anywhere in the United States, really. I mean, it's all different climate zones that he's talking about. So those are some, and I would certainly focus on those, and I wouldn't also dissuade you from looking at some of the classics that are out there that talk about the inspiration you need to be able to be good in the field, to sort of generate that passion. Rachel Carson has always been a great inspiration to me with her Silent Spring. It's that interaction of humans with their environment around them and how we need to pay attention to all of that. It would give you a greater sense of what your motivation should be. And then, of course, well above just some of those books out there, paying attention to plants that are in arboreta around there. Visit as many arboreta and botanical gardens as you possibly can. Travel widely, and that is a great education. And don't forget to plant as many plants as you can in your own yard, because there's no greater experience than tending to some of those different varieties and species yourself. So, Sean, good luck. You've chosen a wonderful area, and if I could be of any further help, don't hesitate to get a hold of me through my website.
And your website, by the way, Bruce, is?
Is allisontree.com.
Allisontree.com. Would the book titled The Tree be John Foles? Would that have been the author?
I read that a couple of times. And is it a British author? Where was it published?
I think it was. I think it was.
Well, it sounds like it's well worth reading, even if it's not exactly the one I'm thinking about. But is it called The Tree? It could very well
be. The title is The Tree.
Okay, excellent. Well, that's probably it then.
All right, and we have Jeff from Brookfield emailed us and has a honey locust that sustained buck rub damage four years ago. Diameter's 3/4 inch or maybe 3 1/4 inch, with about 50% of the circumference damage, about 8 inches long. The buck, what a buck
rub is. Sure, exactly. I'm presuming it's 3/4 inch is the diameter of the tree, or
yeah.
Is that okay? So it's a small tree, 50% gone. It's still young enough where you still would, have a good probability of closure, even though it's a very large area. Honey locusts are legumes. They fix their own nitrogen. They're quite vigorous and have the capability of solving even such a large problem as that. And so I wouldn't worry about it being permanently damaged. I mean, sometimes if you have too large of a wound, you think, well, gee, I'm going to have so much decay, I better take it down now. But that won't be the case here. It can grow rapidly. Protect it from any further damages. Add water if you possibly can, if it's an environment where you can do that. Create a mulch bed around there. Create as positive a growing environment as you can, knowing that the best growing environment is that which replicates that which nature has offered already. So, in a forest setting, you have, mulch at the base.
Yeah.
You don't have competing plants.
And finally, in our last minute, someone from Madison, Eric, wondering, what's the best way to protect their beautiful ash tree from the emerald ash borer?
Well, there's not a heck of a lot you can do right now if you're in a zone where you know it's nearby, and our entomology extension department is telling us that if it's within 10 miles or so, you might want to consider treatment. And there indeed are some, fairly effective treatments, no guarantees, but putting into the soil an insecticide, one that is being used now is imidacloprid. There are other injections of different insecticides that you can do. I know the city of Milwaukee is doing a major injection of a large percentage of their ash trees. Not that they think they can stop it forever, but they want to at least make sure that as they have mortality, it's going to be spread out over time for budgetary reasons. The city of Stevens Point has chosen to go with applying imidacloprid to the soil underneath a large percentage of their ash trees, again, with the same concept. Not that it can solve the problem forever, because you can't be repeating these economically, and a municipal level for a long time. But homeowners do have choices, and we have a lot more choices now than we did 3 or 4 years ago. So we have some good products out there.
Bruce, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to your next – you will come back and be with us again.
Thank you very much, Larry. I'd love to.
Bruce Allison, professional arborist, always a pleasure to have him with us. He does a wonderful job, and it's great to have him here. And I can promise that he will be back again. Just thinking ahead to Monday, we'll talk physical therapy issues with Lori Tynebrody and Bill Boisenault. Have a great weekend. Thanks. Stay with us. Lots in store.